This is the Friday night speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, held at Westgate West in San Jose, California, on December the 8th, 2000. Our speaker tonight is Mary Pat of Campbell, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary Pat, an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome everybody, both the people who announced themselves as visitors, who happen to be friends of mine who came to support me, thank you. And for all the people who may not have announced themselves, who are in fact newcomers, I noticed a few court sheets in the basket, and well, it's all that's part of my story, and I'll get to that in a minute. Just to let you know what it, you know, where I come from, so to speak. I literally grew up about 2 miles from here, and also behind Valley Fair. But this, I've been here for a long time. I came when I was 3 years old, and well, I've been here half a century. I grew up with two parents whom I believe were maintenance alcoholics. I didn't know that until I was about 3 or 4 years sober. I have a sister and a brother. And when I was growing up, we had family far, far away. I didn't know much about my family. I knew that I had some aunts and uncles, and with the exception of one of them who we saw on holidays, I saw him maybe once a year. So we really didn't know anything about the family history, or, you know, certainly not about the problems in the family. The people that my parents chose to have in their lives, which therefore impacted me, were people who were connected to the church. I grew up Catholic, went to parochial schools. I had a very blessed life. My dad was a very hard worker. He had his small business. He sold cars. So he was a used car salesman. He worked 7 days a week. And his usual routine, which is, you know, was modeled for me, was to come home at 7 o'clock at night, get out the bourbon, pour a couple drinks, and then sit for the rest of the night. My mother usually started about 5. And I never knew that there was anything significant about that. I mean, it was just, that was life in my family. I saw either one of my parents high maybe 2 times, 3 times my whole life, at least that I recognized. They didn't talk about alcohol, but they, you know, everything in their life was around alcohol, and that with all their friends. And I can remember, I'm sure my first drink was sipping off of their drinks. I know, I mean, it had to be, because it was all around me. But it wasn't until I was 13 that I took my first drink, in the sense of where I said, okay, I'm going to have some. And this was with a bunch of my girlfriends. I was blessed in the sense of not only did I have a very supportive community around me because of what my parents chose to do, but I was in school environments where I had a lot of close friends. And I always had a lot of friends, but I never felt comfortable. I mean, we hear this in meetings a lot about how we always feel a little different. Well, I always felt a little different, even though I had lots of people around me all the time. This particular group of friends and I that hung around together, all their parents, I mean, if we look back at them, they did the same thing my parents did. So all of us were pretty much modeled into the whole idea of alcohol is fun. Of course, for us, it was mischievous to sneak it, so we did that. I think it was a graduation practice from 8th grade. And I remember there was about 5 of us that went to graduation practice with a little buzz on. And I remember how that drink felt. For whatever period of time that I was under the influence of that alcohol, I felt spontaneous. I didn't feel different. I felt, light. And I liked it. But I didn't pursue it at that time. And part of it was because of, this was taboo in the circles as far as being a teenager at that time. Like I said, I went to a parochial high school, and it wasn't until we were seniors that we really got into it. It just wasn't around that much. So I didn't drink again until I was 17 and a half. In fact, the start of my drinking, in my view, was on December 31st of my senior year. And I didn't stop for 20 and a half years. From the first time that I took a drink, I was able to drink a lot. And I thought that this was really a great deal. I drank most guys under the table. I didn't show when I was high. And that's not to say I wasn't, but it didn't show. And I was able to maneuver quite well under the influence, particularly if I stayed with beer. And that did become my drink of choice, because it's not that I controlled my drinking of beer, but I kind of knew where I was I wasn't sober, but as far as the degree of highness, I could always know where I was. But if I went into mixed drinks, then I wouldn't know for sure what would happen after that. I can only remember having two blackouts in my whole drinking career. One was about 8 months after I started drinking. The other one was probably the year before I stopped drinking. I drank a lot from the time that I started. In college, I was one of the ones that was always organizing the parties, getting the kegs. The early 60s, well, mid-60s, actually, during the time of the Vietnam War and people starting to get into drugs, but I didn't go there. I think the only drug that I took up until my mid-20s was some dexedrine that I took one time to study for finals, and I swore I would never do it again because I was up for 3 days. It just didn't work for me. But I did drink a lot, and it didn't matter whether I had finals or not. I'd be drinking the night before, and of course I'd be partying it up after the finals were over. In fact, most of my the times that I remember where I really did get high, but again, people didn't know it, was in celebration of something being over in college. When I was 23, I graduated from college, had just started a job, the job that I had always wanted, since the time that I was aware of it, it was like the job of my dreams. And I was going to be working as a probation officer. Interesting career that I ended up in. I didn't understand at all that my drinking habits were a problem. The people that I saw in the context of my work were the people that had problems with alcohol, because they were ending up in jail, and you see, I didn't end up in jail. This was my thinking. This was my arrogance. The people I hung around with drank a lot. When I was working in juvenile hall before I got this position as a probation officer, we would go out every single night after work, close the place down, and then be back at work at 7 o'clock. And none of us realized that there was something wrong with that. When I was 23, like right after having gotten my new job, I was involved in a car accident. Now, at the time, I said it had nothing to do with alcohol, but it did. I had been sick for a week. I had the flu. And because I didn't drink as much as I usually did, I said, oh, well, it wasn't alcohol related. The fact was I probably had 5 or 6 beers. I had been, having vomiting and diarrhea all week. But I managed to still, drink that night. And I was hit broadside by some folks coming out of a bar driving 70 miles an hour, and they hit me broadside, and I ended up in the middle of Winchester Boulevard with a broken pelvis and a concussion, and I'm lucky to be here. They didn't think I was going to be here for a while. At the time, it didn't even dawn on me, oh my God, I've been drinking and this could be a problem. Again, I was very lucky because I was I was the one who was most injured, but I was able to talk. I did say, you know, take me to O'Connor Hospital rather than VMC. Had I gone to VMC, they would have done a blood alcohol on me. We all would have been thrown in the can. But as a result of it, none of us did. Like I said, I didn't get that was alcohol related, that whole incident. Within, I was in intensive care for 2 or 3 days, and I was moved up onto a floor because I told you, if you don't get me out of here, I am going to die. I felt totally out of control. This is when I was introduced to Secanol and some other drugs for painkillers. And I liked that too, but I knew that those were trouble. I mean, I could tell by the effect that they had on me that those were trouble. So, I didn't mind getting my shot before I went to sleep at night and when I really needed it, but I didn't ask for anything extra. But what I did do is get very excited when my friends said, hey, we'll start bringing up some kegs after work. So they would truck up the back stairs in the hospital. I was in the hospital for 2 months. And we would party. And there's been a couple things in my life that, you know, are significant, you know, in retrospect. One of them, which I didn't share, there was a period of time when I was in nursing school. And the only patient that I remember that I took care of, and I worked in the hospital several summers, and then as part of being a student, I worked at VMC. The only patient I remember was an elderly gentleman who was in intensive care because of alcoholism. He's the only man I remember. But I remember it. It was like I saw him, and I thought, oh, thank God I don't have to be like him. Not having a clue that I was on my way. Then, when I was in the hospital, I had several roommates over a 2-month period, but one of the gals that was in there, and this was the one time that we first brought up the keg, had a bunch of people in my room partying it up, and I knew this woman was an alcoholic. In fact, that's why she was there. She was part of her problems were related to alcohol, and she was detoxing. And the head nurse came down and just reamed me up one side and down the other for that. I mean, how dare you, you know, do this poor woman, blah, blah, blah. And I was going, okay. So she's another person I'll never forget. I mean, that really had an impression on me that I had been so thoughtless in regards to her, but still I didn't get it in terms of having any relationship to me and having an issue with alcohol. So I managed to recover and continued to drink quite heavily. I drank every single day. I would always come home and have a couple beers after work. On weekends, you know, it was always parties. I frequently, I mean like every weekend, drove under the influence of alcohol. And I never got caught. One time, I was with a bunch of friends from work, and we were going up to Jackson, and we were going to go party at the Jackson Hotel. I mean, that was the nature of our trip. We'd been drinking already for an hour or two, and we're going to drive up there, and I don't show that I'm under the influence, right? So I get to be the designated driver. And I got stopped. We weren't even off of 680, and if it wasn't for the fact that I had my identification near my license, and I didn't even realize I had it there. I mean, it wasn't anything that I did to try and get out of the situation. I was just oblivious. The highway patrolman recognized my name and said, oh, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm just going to Jackson. You know, and I was speeding. And had he done anything more than that, you know, and asked me to get out of the car or anything, he would have known that I'd been drinking. So again, I didn't get caught. I drank through my pregnancies. I have 3 kids that all have learning disabilities, which I think may be related to that. And in those days, we didn't know as much as we do about alcoholism and the use of alcohol and the effects on kids as we do now. But I knew on some level I shouldn't be drinking. And I didn't drink as much as I usually did, but I did still drink significantly. By the time I had my third child, I was drinking minimally a six-pack a day. And I would, at that time, I was also very much involved in sports activities that were related to work. You know how you have teams related to work? Well, we played softball or we played soccer. Well, with soccer, you start early in the morning. You play any time between 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock in the morning. And then it was drinking from then until 10 o'clock that night. And it was like constant. And then when it was softball season, it was, you know, until 2 o'clock in the morning. I received a black eye once from one of my teammates who was upset because I took the keys away from her because she couldn't drive like I could. We'd both been drinking the same, and I got popped in the eye, so I had to go to work to and explain, well, no, it wasn't my husband that had done that. I mean, you know, and I still didn't get it. I didn't get that there was anything related to the fact that I was using alcohol to the way I was. I would write reports, and I'd be up all night writing these reports because I had these three little kids I was trying to take care of, and there'd be my can of beer. You know, every night that I did this, I'd be drinking. There was one fellow at work who everybody knew was an alcoholic. In fact, he lost his job as a result of it. But it never occurred to me that I was an alcoholic. I remember that my parents had once said that my uncle was an alcoholic, but that was about as much as they said about it. Your uncle's an alcoholic, but he didn't drink anymore. I don't know whether he went to AA or not, but he was the only one that I ever heard of, even remotely related to the family, where the issue of alcoholism was even brought up. In my work, I knew about drinking problems because I had to deal with parents who, because of their alcohol use, endangered their children. In fact, I had my job at that time was to do child abuse investigation, and so I would be removing kids from their families, and didn't get it that I was doing the same thing to my kids that these folks were doing. The difference was their life looked different than mine, but I was probably drinking just as much as they were. I just wasn't getting caught. After my third child and my drinking really kind of kicked off, and that was because I was unfaithful in my marriage, and that's when I really, I mean, that did it. I mean, I was really drinking up a storm because I was engaged in behavior that was totally contrary to everything I'd ever been brought up with. I had always been looked at by my peers and by my close friends as kind of the rock, you know, the touchstone, the person that doesn't go off. I mean, I would always, you know, when we were kids, I would always be the instigator, but it was never, you know, anything big. It was stupid stuff, like, I mean, I was always around alcohol, you know, putting things in fountains and, you know, just driving the car when you're not supposed to, joyriding, stuff like that. But I didn't realize that I had a problem. And but here I was engaged in this behavior that I was so ashamed of because I was violating my relationship and the commitment that I had made. So that really helped escalate my drinking to the point that no matter what I did, whether it was Lent, if I tried to give it up for Lent or if I went on a diet, I couldn't go a day without alcohol. I'd say, okay, I'm not going to have any beer. And I might go, you know, for a week with no beer, but I started with wine because I didn't care about wine. And I had no understanding that that meant anything. No matter what I did, I couldn't go a day without drinking. And it just really confounded me because everything else in my life seemed like it was, you know, I could get by except for this unusual behavior I was engaged in. But, you know, I could hold down a job. I could take care of three kids. I could do all that I could do. And I was very self-sufficient. But I couldn't do that. I could not go a day without drinking. And in fact, it got to the point where my drinking buddy, who was my neighbor, one day said to me in the fall of 1982, "Gee, Mary Pat, I think you're a beer alcoholic." A beer alcoholic. So I go, "Oh yeah, okay, a beer alcoholic, I can buy that, because I do drink a lot of beer." But I still didn't get it, the alcoholic part. Didn't know what that, I didn't really get it in terms of what does that really mean. But I started noticing more about how I couldn't go, no matter what I did, I couldn't go a day without. So it was also around this time that a series of events kind of all came together, and you'll hear this for those of you who stick around, you know, like keep coming back, some more will be revealed. About all at this same time, several other things happened. A good friend of mine, who we were planning our high school reunion, we started seeing each other, and she was a person who was very spiritual and talked a lot about God and choice and free will and all this stuff. My mother was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. My father had died of it when I was 25, so I knew what was in store for me. And on some level, I knew that I wanted to be present for her in a way that I hadn't been for him. I was just too young to get it, and, you know, what I needed to do. And I didn't want to miss the boat with her, but I didn't know what that meant. I just knew I didn't want to miss the boat. And then this friend, you know, continuing to say, "You're a beer alcoholic." So just coincidentally, at my work, there was a class offered on alcoholism. So I thought, okay, I think I'll check that out. And the way they had it set up is that you have an 8-hour class 3 weeks in a row. So I show up at the first class, and they start talking about alcoholism as a disease. Now, I had heard that before, but I didn't get it before. But I got it that day. I got it that it was a compulsion, that it was like an allergy, that it wasn't something that I needed, you know, to feel a lot of shame about, even though even though they talked about that. I go, "Well, yeah, I can do everything else. Why can't I do this?" But for some reason, it just hit me right. It was like, "Oh, that explains it. That's what's wrong with me." Then the other side of that was, "Oh, what am I going to do about this?" And it was like, there's only one answer. And that is, and I was listening, is that I'm going to have to stop drinking. And what was interesting about that experience, and I think the thing that really cemented it for me, was the teacher was somebody from the National Council on Alcoholism. And she really spent quite a bit of time on the disease concept. But one of the ways she started the class was she looked around, and of course, being the self-centered alcoholic that I later found out myself to be, thought she was looking right at me when she said, "What does an alcoholic look like?" Well, I thought, sure, she was looking at me. I really did. To this day, I thought she was looking at me. And, you know, the usual description of alcohol as a person with the male with the trench coat and the bag and the bottle, that was what a lot of the people in the room said. And then she provided another description and had some folks who were in recovery come in and talk. And it was like, on some level, that made it okay for me. I mean, because I wasn't a person, you know, with the bottle in the bag this day anyway, on other occasions. And it was like, okay, that's the reason. That's it. I also was at a place in time where, because of the shame that I was feeling regarding my behavior, I was at, all I want to do is touch people in a positive way. I don't want to harm people. And interestingly, at the second class, a week later, the whole topic was about what happens to the family as a result of alcoholism. And that did it for me. It was like, yeah, okay, I knew that there was these families that I had dealt with in my work life. I thought I was different than them. I wasn't different than them. I just didn't get caught. And that whatever was going on with them and their kids was going on with me and my kids, and that I had to make a decision about what to do about that. I'd also, previous to that, made the decision that I was going to stop drinking, like I could do it on my own, the day after the last class. So for those whole 3 weeks, I was getting ready. And I knew in my heart of hearts that I was letting go of my best friend. I finally realized that alcohol had been my best friend. I cried every night. Of course, I drank every night, but I also cried every night. I mean, I don't cry, period, and I don't think I've cried much since I got sober. But I cried for 3 solid weeks because I knew that I was leaving my best friend, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I had not a clue. And I can remember saying, God, I don't know what I'm going to do, but you're going to have to figure it out. So on the last day of class, after the class was over, I went up to the teacher and at the end, and I said, you know, I think I'm alcoholic. What do I do? And she looked at me like I was crazy and said, haven't you been paying attention for 3 weeks talking about going to AA? And I didn't want to hear that because I had gone to an AA meeting when I was in college to do a paper. And all I remember when I walked in was everybody talking about God. Now, it didn't matter that I went to Mass every Sunday and that I did have a faith since I was a little kid. I didn't want to be a Jesus freak, which goes back to that friend of mine who was doing her spiritual thing when we were planning our reunion. Because on some level, as much as I heard her, I didn't want to be like she was, proselytizing and doing, because I thought that's what it would mean to me, that I'd have to do that. I don't think so. So she goes, well, all I know is that this seems to be the most effective way to respond to the disease of alcoholism is to get into a program of recovery. And she said, what I recommend is that you go to 90 meetings in 90 days and that you keep going to a lot of different meetings until you find some that you're really comfortable with. And she recommended a step meeting and a book meeting and also stick with the women. I said, okay. So I had my last drink at 11:59 that night. My drinking partner was there watching me drink, and I dragged her off to a noon meeting. We went up to Los Gatos because I thought, oh, it's probably, you know, a good meeting in Los Gatos, you know, like it's going to be different. So as usual, I got there late, and I walked in right when people were introducing themselves. Now, I didn't know what the rules were, right? And I've always been a people pleaser, so it's like, oh, okay, everybody's announcing themselves, I'll do that. So I get up and I say, I'm Mary Pat, I'm an alcoholic. And at the time, even though my motive for doing it was, you know, maybe not what I wished it was, something happened in that moment when I said, I'm Mary Pat and I'm an alcoholic. And from that point on, I knew that that's what I had to say every time I walked into a meeting. There was something about identifying that really made the difference for me. My biggest fear was that I was going to run into clients. Of course I did. That was the best thing that happened to me because I was so full of pride. And when they go, oh, what are you doing here? Are you here, you know, checking on people? Or are you going, no, I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. Which was the best thing that could have happened to me is to have to admit to at my innermost core what the truth was. But I didn't have to do what you did. I just needed to quit drinking, right? Being a little arrogant person that I was. After all, I'd had all these psychology classes, and after all, I hadn't been to jail, and I didn't get it that I'd been to a hospital, I didn't get any of that for a long time. So I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I got that, step one. But my life wasn't unmanageable, thank you very much, and I was not insane. I knew what insanity was because I had dealt with a lot of clients who had mental health problems, and their situation was nothing like mine. Thank you very much. Plus, my mother had been insane when I was in high school. I knew what that was, so, and I wasn't like her, so I wasn't insane. So I didn't need to do the steps, is what I told myself. And I'll just come once a week, and I kind of like the meetings. So I thought, I'll just come once a week and see what happens, and you know, because I don't want to drink anymore. I was blessed with the obsession being lifted immediately. And, you know, I don't believe I, in that sense, that I deserved it, because I certainly hadn't done anything to deserve it. I just showed up. Didn't have the compulsion, liked the meetings, but I wasn't going to do this much more than I had to do. And my life wasn't unmanageable. It didn't matter that I was unfaithful in my marriage, that, you know, we started talking about separating, having divorce. I'd probably still be married to my husband if he hadn't said he just couldn't do it anymore. He was just so depressed. A divorce was not an option in my mind. So it was kind of like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And he said, you know, I can't take it anymore. He was totally depressed. So we decided to separate. And we did all the right things. I continued to go to my once a week meeting. And we got the kids in counseling, getting ready for the big separation. And I planned to go back to work, you know, everything in its place. Go back to work full time. And I did that. And all of a sudden, the word unmanageable came into my life. Because I had to go back to work full time, started experiencing what it was like to share custody of kids, deal with their reaction, deal with mine. My mother was on her last leg, I knew that. And all of a sudden, I got it. So I went to a few more meetings. I still didn't go to what was recommended. Then in December, and I think it was probably this week, my first year sober, and I had been going to the Tuesday women's meeting up in Cupertino now since my second meeting. And I'd gotten to know a few women only because they grabbed me at the end of the meeting and dragged me off to coffee because I was too shy to, you know, do anything about socializing. And so I was asked to chair. Well, that had to be the most humbling experience, because when I had the chair, I realized that I didn't know a thing. I had nothing to share. All I could share was, you know, what happened, that I stopped drinking and that I remembered that I wanted to touch people in a positive way. That's all I could say, because I didn't have a program. The good news is that through that experience, I went out and got myself a sponsor right away. I started going to 90 meetings in 90 days, which worked out very, very well for me, because it turns out I got sober on January 28th, 1983. My mother died on January 28th, 1984. So on my first AA birthday, my mother was in the dying process, and it was the most spiritual experience that I have ever had. And it was like everything that I'd heard in the program up until that time. I had people in the room with me at that time. Everything I had heard all came together at once. And it's like I really, really got it. By this time, I was hedging on the third step. I'm going, oh, my God, turn my will over? I don't think so. I'd grown up Catholic, after all, and all we ever heard about was how we have free will. And I didn't get it. I didn't understand what turning my will over to God meant. We never talked about that in my catechism classes. We only talked about free will. Well, that same friend of mine, the one that was the spiritual one, you know, we were still seeing each other, and I asked her the question, what does this mean? I didn't get it. So I go, well, what do you think it means? And she goes, well, it means that you choose to give your will to God. That you're making the choice, that by your free will, you're choosing to do that. And I go, oh, okay, I get it. Duh. But then I was afraid, because if I did that, I don't know what's going to happen. And after all this fear, you know, is starting to come up now. I've been sober long enough and starting to come to, and I'm starting to get scared. And that's what that unmanageability was about. So I was afraid to really do the third step. But I was working with a sponsor at this time, and so I was thinking a lot about it, and I'd gotten the, came to believe in a higher power. It was about this time. I mean, my biggest fear was that I was going to have to go back to my husband. That was the thing that was holding me back from turning my will and my life over. And lo and behold, right in the middle of kind of when I was playing with that, the phone rings, and he says, "Don't you think it's time we do something and go ahead with the paperwork?" And I go, oh, yeah, okay. So then I got the third step. So I was ready to go. And I said, I guess it's God's will for me to do this, so I'm going to go do this. And I also had a lot of support during that time from people in the program, because now I was hanging out with people in the program. I was doing my 90 meetings in 90 days. And I was ready to make a fourth step. I wanted, like nothing else, to get the shame and the guilt off my plate. For those of you who grew up Catholic, you know what I'm talking about. If you had a religious practice and you went to confession every week, and that was what your experience was, and that was mine, confession was good for me. I mean, I'd always gotten something out of it. So to be able to make that inventory and tell the whole truth, the real truth, to somebody that I trusted was huge. And it wasn't surprising that I picked a woman who had very much the same background that I did, as far as life story. Everything changed for me at that point when I started working the steps. The people that I hung around were all people in the program. I went through some times where I didn't know if I was going to lose custody of my kids or not. I didn't know if I could do my job. It got very stressful, and it was just kind of doing one day at a time. And I started using all the cliches that we hear in the program. Keep it simple, one day at a time. Whatever I was doing was an errand for God. That made life doable. I could do that. Because otherwise, I would have been a basket case. I was also starting to feel very guilty about all the arrogance and the pride that had gone into my, my work. And here I am, I'm just like everybody else. And actually, I had a blessed life, and look at all these people who didn't have half of what I had as far as opportunities and gifts. And here they are, doing what they need to do to stay sober, and I was sitting on my butt for a year. It was really humiliating. I really got a good dose of what self-will run riot is all about, and what fear is all about. It was too scary for me to admit what was really the truth. And it was about this time that I finally understood what the word insanity was for me in my life, and that was denial. And when I realized that that's what it was for me, that made a huge difference, an acceptance of that I do this in a lot of different ways, and that it's going to take a lot of courage to face things that are presented to me. But if I just keep showing up and I don't take a drink and I tell the truth, that everything is going to be okay. And that's pretty much what I've had to do. I welcomed the fifth step. I was like, okay, let's get this taken care of. It was very freeing for me to really tell someone else. I knew God already knew. I believe that. And that was okay. I mean, I didn't stay with the guilt. I feel really bad about how I wasn't available to my kids, but the only thing I can do is today. I can do better today. I can't undo what I did before. When it came to being entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character, it took me quite a few years in the program to really get that I had defects of character. It's amazing what pride will do. But I knew about pride, because when I did my inventory, that was my number one thing. Pride, which hid the fear and the fear of abandonment. And that for me, for all the inventories that I've done, and I like to do four-step inventories because it's so freeing for me, because I can always get down to what the real issues really are. And it's always about Mary Pat's self-esteem, pride, security, all the time. It doesn't matter what it is. And it's all fear-based. I am the classic alcoholic, self-centered fear. That's me. When I made my list of the people I had harmed, I didn't have a real long list in the sense of people that I had actively harmed. My family, definitely. My parents were gone. So my amends to them were, about being a better parent. And, I did my little letters to my mom and to my dad, and that was very freeing, too. But my real work was with my children, trying to be a better person with my coworkers, with my extended family. and to try and become a more loving person, to be a servant rather than a taker. And I don't do that very well all the time, but I mean, I realize that's why I'm here. I mean, why didn't I get killed in the car accident? I mean, all these things that, how come I didn't get caught and get put in jail for a long time or whatever? So I knew that I had some work to do. I didn't do a lot of 12-step work at this time because of work. It was, you know, all the time I was involved in some way related to alcohol and recommending to people. And that's why when I said all the sign-in things, I always recommended people come and check out the program or at least get in some kind of education because, if you're like me, I didn't know that I didn't know. I just didn't know. And here I had the opportunity to know and I didn't know. So think of all the people who didn't have the opportunity to know. And so I thought, well, if that's the least I can do, and I know they're going to be held accountable because the law violation was alcohol related, that if all that I can do is recommend that they be exposed to information so that they can make choices, then I've done the best job I can do. And that's kind of how I've looked at that. I made the amends that I needed to make. I didn't tell my husband everything because that would have harmed him. I didn't tell my children everything because that would have harmed them. Thankfully, I really trusted the advice of my sponsor, and I did go to her and listen to her and accept her guidance. And for somebody like me who has so much pride and who's such a know-it-all, to have a sponsor is pretty big. And to say that my life is better because of that, absolutely. There isn't anything that I can't handle now. I mean, that's one of the things I've learned. There was a point in time where I knew that I was going to need to deal with some issues relating to my behavior that could risk whether or not my ex would allow me to have my children. And I was prepared to go through with that because I knew it was the right thing to do. But I learned that here. And it wasn't that I wasn't scared. And I had people in the program. My friend Neil, who's here, was there with me that day. You know, I had to make this, you know, discussion that related to family court stuff. And I've also learned to take a look at my side of the street doing a personal inventory. I'm not good about, you know, doing the 10-step every night at the end of my day and checking, you know, how are my assets, what are my liabilities. But I try to stay, and I am pretty much in tune with when I start feeling uncomfortable about something, it's about something that I've done or said or whatever. And if I'm reacting to somebody else, it's that I do have a piece of the action. And I know that because I've done enough inventories about it. In fact, this last year and a half, actually, I've probably done more inventories within a very short period than I did, you know, early on in my sobriety. And it has to do with dealing with people. What's my side of the street? And, you know, I can get real self-righteous and get into my justification and say, well, they're the ones with the problem. But, you know, it's how I react to it. I've gotten to the point now where I'm not comfortable being uncomfortable. So the only way to deal with that and stay sober is to not take a drink and to get into action. And that's what the program has taught me. My prayer life, you know, in terms of the 11th step has been up and down. I happen to be in a dry spell right now. I do feel disconnected. And it's not surprising that the whole issue that I'm dealing with right now is how to develop my spiritual life. And it's at the time when I feel most distant. I've had a few other times in my sobriety where that's been the case. But I've always known that my higher power is there for me. I've had strange symbolism around my higher power. And in the early years of my sobriety, it was a homeless person. And whenever things would be really bad, and I'd be ready to just go on, oh, forget you, God, you're not answering my prayers or whatever, sure enough, a homeless person would step in my path, and we'd have an interaction, and it would be different. I remember this one time in Santa Cruz, I was just really in a low spot. I didn't feel like drinking, but I was really in a low spot. And I had gone over to the beach to, you know, just when I go to the beach, I feel close to my higher power. So I did that. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to go to the show. And so I go through some shopping center. I'm going to get a sandwich before I go to the show. And this street person came up to me. And being my little self-righteous self, the person said, you know, I just got off a train and I'm really hungry. Can you give me some money? And I said, well, I'm not willing to give you any money, but I'll be willing to buy you lunch. So we go in, and I'm getting all irritated because, you know, the show's going to start any minute, and I'm waiting for his lunch. It just, I mean, the pride, the arrogance is really something. So anyway, I'm doing my little number. I get his sandwich, take it out. He didn't want to come in because he did look pretty bad, and he didn't smell too good. So anyway, he waits out there. I go, yeah, here's your bag. I got to go. See ya. So I start to walk away and feel like, oh, yeah, well, maybe he'll go to an AA meeting tonight or something. You know, I'm just going on and on about how much I've done for this guy in my little wonderful world. And he yells, lady, lady. And I go, yeah? And he goes, God loves you. And I didn't get it because I was so busy trying to get to the show. I didn't get it in that moment. Oh, yeah, 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 okay, I know that. So later on, when I found there was no theater, I'd forgotten that there had been the earthquake in downtown Santa Cruz. There was no theater there. But I don't know why this paper still had it listed. This must have been in 89, I guess. Anyway, I'm starting to drive back over the hill, and I'm you know, still bemoaning my terrible plight. I was really lonely is what it was. And it suddenly dawned on me what happened. And I went, holy smokes. That whole thing was for me. That whole thing was to say, I'm with you, and that God loves me. And that's how it's been. And I've had many times when things have been tough, and there'll be a homeless person who's there. That hasn't happened now in a couple years. In fact, all my friends, I got so used to the stories that they will. In fact, tonight, my friend Rose asked me, well, what about, you know, if you run into a create opportunities for other people in my life. And if I wasn't sober and I wasn't working the steps, it wouldn't happen. I mentioned that I'm having a tough time spiritually right now with the connection. I'm saying my prayers and I'm going to lots of meetings and I'm doing some reading, not as much as I used to, but I just have a terrible time with meditation. It's very hard for me. So I've decided that when I'm moving, I can meditate. Like when I'm walking, I can do like a walking meditation. So my next plan of attack is to get into doing labyrinths. I don't know if you know what those are, but circular thing. And I found that when I do that, it quiets me and it works. So, you know, that's, you know, it's kind of like we learn in here, we do what we can. You will find your own way, just like I did. My way is not going to fit probably for most people, and most people's way isn't going to fit for me. But by coming to lots of meetings and listening to lots of stories, I have a bag of tools that's huge. And I go into it all the time, whether it's saying a prayer or calling somebody in the program. Doing 12-step work. I'm doing a lot more of that this year. As I mentioned, I've been very blessed to be very blessed to have the opportunities, not just in terms of being sober, to have the support that I have and to have had the lessons that I've had and to know that my higher power is with me. A year ago today, I was diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer. And, you know, I was okay. My family and friends flipped out. I was fine. But it was because of my connection to my higher power. It was just like, you know what? I'm powerless over this. All I can do is get into action, take one step at a time. And what I prayed for was guidance on making decisions. I've learned that for me, the best thing to pray for is God's will for me, or how can I be of help to someone else. And in this case, it was I just want to be guided to the right decisions for me. Your will, not mine, be done. And I breezed through everything. I mean, if you had to get breast cancer, I got the I got the best kind. It's gone. I had minimum amount of treatments. I did have treatments. I improved taking care of myself. I'm still not there yet, taking really good care of myself. But I did a lot better than I usually do. I didn't drink. I went to lots of meetings during that time. And it also happened right before my birthday. My AA birthday is, like I said, January 28th. So all this, and as a routine practice before my birthday, I usually go to at least 30 meetings in 30 days as a gift to myself. So I was already, you know, started in that, and that really helped me. It was also hard for me to cut back at work. I'm also a workaholic, and I also was in charge of a big project, and I felt that I needed to do all this stuff and how I was going to take care of myself at the same time, I wasn't sure. But I knew that I could trust my higher power, that if I needed to let go of my work, that I could do that. I was not called to do that. But I did make the decision to go ahead and retire. And so on August 25th, I retired after 32 years working for as a public servant. And, you know, when I look back at, you know, I was sober as long as I was drinking in my job. And even though, you know, if you look back, I can look back over my career and know that I did a good job the whole time. But the job that I did from the point that I got sober was so much different. And what all of you have given me through your stories and your sharing and your support has been an opening of my compassion for other people and my understanding that whatever the situation is, and I, of course I forget this most with my loved ones and my kids, is that they're doing the very best they can at that time. And all I can do is, you know, make suggestions. If I have information that might be of help to them, to give it, it's up to them to get there. I'd love to see my three sons walk in this room. And I don't know whether that's ever going to happen. But I'd love to see it because of what I've gotten and how much better my life is as a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have so many tools here. So many things that we can do to improve our day-to-day life, our serenity, our peace of mind. I've gone to retreats in the program, and that's really helped me have a better understanding of who my higher power is for me. I feel blessed that I did have a higher power coming in here, and I really have a great deal of respect for those people who didn't have a higher power as they came in and had to find one. Because I do think it's very, very difficult to embrace the program and the steps when, because of personal experience or whatever, that higher power isn't there in a big way. You know, my God is a lot bigger now than my God was when I stepped in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Way a lot bigger. And my life is bigger. Everything is bigger. I have hope. I get excited about anybody who comes in to the program. I remember this one gal who at work who came up to me after my mother died. I'm a year sober now, and I'm just starting to get in the program. And she comes up to me about 2 weeks afterwards and just checking in, how you doing? And she says, I don't know how you did it. And I said, well, to tell you the truth, the way I was able to do it is because I wasn't drinking and I had lots of support. And that's all I said. So about 6 months later, she calls me, and she says, can we have lunch? So we go to lunch, and she says, you know, Mary Pat, I have a problem with alcohol. What do you think I ought to do? And she got into the program. She got a sponsor, and God bless her, she developed melanoma, and as far as I know, she died with 3 years of sobriety. You know, but that was a blessing for me to witness her life. And especially to have the gifts of the program as she was ending her life and to witness her strength and her courage. And she's really been a model for me in mine. The people in my life have demonstrated such courage and such faith and willingness to go to any lengths. Most of the people that I hang around with in the program go to at least 4 or 5 meetings a week. I try to get to that many myself. I'm able to go more now, too, with not being at work. And that's what really works for me. My spiritual awakening is kind of like every day. Every day I get to have a moment of where I can see that I'm blessed or that opportunities present themselves and doors open that I would have never guessed in a million years. And the things that I used to be afraid of losing and maybe lost have turned out to really be assets in my life. I know about 2 years ago I was at a conference over at St. Clair's, a retreat. And at the retreat master was talking about, I think he was talking about step 3 and also step 11. And I want to share with you what was shared with me, and I use this. Thank you, God, for what you have given me. Thank you, God, for what you have taken away. Thank you, God, for what you have left me to do your will today. Everything I need to do God's will today, I have. I am perfect in this moment. I have everything I need in this moment. And that's what I forget when I start getting antsy or squirrely or not feeling too hot. It's I forget this. I always have my higher power to go to. And on those occasions when and alcohol still, rears its wild head in front of me now and then. Not that I feel like I want to drink, but it's like when you say you go into a room, and I'm sure this has happened to most of you. Some people are drinking, and for me, of course, it's beer. There's the beer bottle, and all of a sudden, that might be the only thing I see in the room. I don't feel like drinking, but I see that beer bottle, and that reminds me big time that my disease is alive and well. I'm just one drink away from a drunk. And there is no difference between me and anybody who is a newcomer here. I'm one drink away from a drunk also. It doesn't matter how many years I have. And everything is contingent on my spiritual relationship with my higher power, who I choose to call God. And that's why right now it's a little scary for me, because I don't it's not like I feel the joy that I might have felt at other times. The good news is I know that my higher power is working in my life. I know that because I've been around long enough to know that. I don't see it every minute, but I know it to be true. So I want to thank all of you for the gifts of your sobriety to me. I'm, God willing, going to celebrate 18 years on January 28th. I have a good life. I have 2 wonderful grandchildren I get to enjoy and be sober with. I really get to be present for my children now. They're adults, but I'm present for them now in a way that I wasn't when they were kids. And if that's how I make my amends to them, then that's what I get to do. I get to do it with my grandchildren. And if I had continued drinking, I don't know when I would have crossed that line to, I don't know, and I don't want to find out. You know, I don't want to get to that point that I heard about where I have no control and all I do is drink. It's not that I had control then, but I mean, I didn't want to get to the place where I knew I would get in just a matter of time. And I witnessed that through you folks who did have that happen to you. So I want to thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for letting me share. And I do hope that all of you will keep coming back. And for the newcomers, it's because of you that the rest of us are sober. So it's really, really important to keep coming back. Thank you.